today is how the detectors work and what my imagination tells me they'll look like in the future. So this is an outline of the talk, just a little bit of introduction on how these things work and the new things going on with the global network, the detectors in other countries, and then the future of them. So I think in this place, there's not much to tell about this introductory material. You all, I'm sure, understand how this works. But the... a little bit loud. The gravitational waves I want to tell you about today are the linearized approximation, so not what goes on nearby the sources where the space-time strain can be of order unity, but in fact the strain that we are able to detect here on the Earth or within the solar system where the sources are extremely distant relative to the size of the detector, and all of the perturbations to the metric are linear. So for linearized gravitational waves, we're looking for things which more or less obey the intuition you have about electromagnetic waves. There are two polarizations. Rather than fluctuations of the electromagnetic field, there are fluctuations in the space-time itself. And I guess, does anyone have a pointer? Oh, all right. Well, I'm going to point with my finger. I mean, you can more or less get it. So what I'm showing there in the middle is a cartoon of a ring of test masses. So we start off with a ring, which is the blue circles, and then the plus polarized. You can imagine the wave is coming in from above, and we're looking at the surface of the Earth from above. And as the wave comes through, the so-called plus polarized waves give you a plus pattern of alternating stretching and squeezing. And the cross ones give you the same, but rotated by 45 degrees. And so if you'd like to measure these things, you'd like to have a detector that can measure the difference between the direction which is being stretched and the direction which is being squeezed. So some sort of differential measurement. And through some dimensional analysis, you can convince yourself that the amplitude of these waves, by the time they get to the Earth, for something which is roughly solar mass and radiating a few percent of its rest mass in radiation, and is some sort of reasonable astrophysical distance away, outside of the galaxy, but not yet at cosmological distances. Those things will make a dimensionless strain on the Earth somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to the minus 20 to 10 to the minus 22 or 23, which is a tiny number. And to turn it into something practical, we multiply it by the length of our meter stick. So if we had a meter stick, which was 10 to the 19 meters, we would be okay. We would see a 1 centimeter change or so, which is reasonable. We don't have anything like that. So the largest things that we can imagine making on the Earth are sort of a few kilometers in size. And so for those, the distances that we are trying to measure are really quite tiny, 10 to the minus 18 to 10 to the minus 20 meters. And I think reasonably, when you hear numbers like that, you should be extremely skeptical. And if I was to stand up here and tell you that we were trying to measure a strain of 10 to the minus 40 and look for distances of 10 to the minus 37 meters, you should just laugh and have me removed. It's not worth your time to listen to something like that. But I want to convince you that this kind of displacement is actually in the realm of something which is reasonable to measure. So people for a long time have argued whether or not gravitational waves were real or not, or whether they were just some sort of fluctuation of the coordinate system. In 1974, 75, Russell Hulse and Joe Taylor observed a modulated signal using the Arecibo dish in Puerto Rico. And then after a few years, noticed that the period was decaying, as you'd expect, if it was losing energy to gravitational radiation. It took 4 or 5 years, and there was a series of good papers about it in the early 80s, and then around 14 or 15 years later, they got the Nobel Prize for this discovery and showing that it was, in fact, due to gravitational radiation. So either gravitational waves are real and they carry away energy, as this measurement proves, or there's another mechanism which is extremely pathologically close to what it does. And I think people generally believe that they're now real because of this observation and of other binary pulsars. So the LIGO detectors are designed to look for all kinds of sources, but roughly they're all in the audio band. And I'll tell you about some of the other detectors as well, but mostly these are the sources we're focused on. And the area of greatest sensitivity is between 50 hertz and 1,000 hertz or so. And this places us in the regime where the sources that we are looking for are around a solar mass or tens to maybe 100 solar masses at most. But neither are we looking for extremely tiny objects or any supermassive black holes or things. So this is just a graphic of what these things look like in terms of signal processing basis. Some of them are slowly modulated signals like the chirp signal. Some are transients like supernovae or unpredicted sources. We expect for continuous sources like pulsars, which have a small ellipticity, those will look really just like a continuous wave signal at a single frequency. And their frequency content will only be almost entirely due to the fact that the Earth itself is moving and Doppler modulating the waves which are coming from somewhere within the galaxy. Depending on whether you're an astronomer or a physicist, the most interesting sources that we'd like to detect are those from the very early universe and the gravitational waves, which may come from inflation or some other very early universe process. As it turns out, the estimate for the strength of the radiation from the early universe, like Big Bang, is too low to be detected by any of the current detectors or any of the detectors that we expect to have in the next 10 to 15 years. But people are designing detectors to look for these inflationary sources within the next sort of 3 to 4 decades. So now, in the next few slides, I just want to tell you about the beginnings of this effort. So in the late 60s, Joe Weber thought that he could come up with some sort of technology to find gravitational radiation from the galaxy, from impulsive sources. And so the idea was that he would make these large resonant aluminum bars, and he's ringed them around with piezoelectric strain transducers, which convert the stretching of the bar into a voltage signal. And he set up several of these bars and looked for signals. And throughout the late 60s and the early 70s, he thought he was making detections. And other researchers set up their own detectors to try to verify these claims. And that went on throughout all of the 70s, and basically no one was able to replicate his results. And so we now think that there was some instrumental or analysis errors in his analysis. So even though probably his events were not real, the excitement in both the theoretical and experimental community was enough to give birth to this whole field. So it started in this somewhat awkward way, but it got going and is now at a level of moderately big science and is really international. In the early 80s, people made prototypes for the now modern detectors. There were sort of small-scale interferometric detectors in California and MIT and Germany and Glasgow. And they did well with these up until the early 90s and had enough experience that they could put forward reasonably good proposals for big money, full-size detectors of the kilometer scale. And so those have been built and operated in the U.S. and throughout Europe and Japan, and in the future, perhaps in India. So this cartoon at the bottom, it's not quite the same for all the detectors, but more or less it gives you the idea of how they work. A laser beam illuminates a partially transmitting mirror from the left, and then goes into these two resonant cavities where the light circulates some hundreds of times and interacts with the gravitational wave, which acts as just a strain in space and gives some phase shift on the light. And so the resonant cavity acts just to build up this phase shift resonantly. And then the light comes back, and in the absence of a gravitational wave, there's no signal at the photodetector, and in the presence of a gravitational wave, we see a fluctuating laser power, and we interpret that as a signal. And There's a lot more to it, but more or less, that's the scheme. So this is a timeline of the whole business so far. Up until the 90s, as I said, they were operated mostly by prototypes, and you can see the sensitivity here in this plot. So on the y-axis, I've plotted the spectral density of the strain noise at the optimum point of each detector. And you can see the evolution. The resonant bar detectors improved by several orders of magnitude and basically finished operating around 2000. The interferometric detectors, the prototype started off in the early 70s. This inflection point, you see the corner, is the time when the full-size kilometer detectors came on, the LIGO detectors and their counterparts in the other countries. And so the blue ones are interferometers, and the red ones are bars, and the green, which I'll talk about, are detectors which don't exist yet. So this is a single snapshot of what the LIGO detectors look like. They're these type of interferometers, Michelson's type interferometers, which have 4 kilometer arms. One is in southeastern Washington State, and one is in southeastern Louisiana, close to New Orleans. As you can get a character, you can see the character, and they're in these remote places, away, far away from cities, to be away from seismic vibrations. The Washington one is in the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, where plutonium was produced for the war, and the one in Louisiana is, it's in a swamp. It's Louisiana, so that's what you get. As it turns out, swamps are bad places to put sensitive scientific instruments, as we've learned over the past decade or so. Although I won't go into the details of any of these other detectors, this is just to get you a feel for what the gravitational wave, it says spectrum, but it looks like a rainbow, but gravitational waves are really more like sound, but this is their kind of optical visual analog, except for that I've stretched it out logarithmically, which is really unfair. So on the red end is the largest scale waves, and which come from inflation, and these create distortion in the cosmic microwave background, and so several of the detectors now are looking for signatures in the polarization of the microwave background, first at small scales with things being launched from the South Pole and then also in the Chilean desert, and eventually with an all-sky probe, maybe called the inflation probe. And then there's nothing for several decades in frequency. The pulsar timing community is doing well, and they in fact may be the first to make this detection, and they are looking for signals like the coalescence of supermassive black holes, which might create signals at this nanohertz to tenths of microhertz regime. And then the LISA mission, which until recently was a ESA-NASA mission, is now just an ESA mission, is meant to be a flying interferometer in space of millions of kilometers length, and that would be sensitive to extremely low frequency waves around the millihertz, which would come from perhaps solar mass objects merging into supermassive black holes. And then the ultraviolet band here is all of the Earth-based acoustic detectors. And those one day might go from as low of a frequency as a few hertz up to tens of kilohertz and probably not above. So just to go into a little more detail on how these detectors work and what the limits are. I think in the later part of the talk, I'll tell you about what we're doing in the future, but to motivate it, I have to tell you a little bit about the limits so far. So there's two limits which are interesting, and generally when you talk about this and say, I have this detector which can measure down to 10 to the minus 19 meters or so, there's two objections that people generally have and say, here are reasons why it won't work. And one is that we live at finite temperature, and so all of the molecules in any of your detecting apparatus must have half a kT of thermal energy, and they're vibrating, and atoms are at least an angstrom in size. So how can you measure things which are a billion times or 10 billion times smaller than the size of an atom? That's a legitimate complaint. Hopefully I'll tell you about that. This picture is just to talk about the other issue, which is Given the fact that you have finite precision with which you can measure things with light, how can you really do better than this? And in the, I'll tell you a little bit about why this picture is even incorrect. But the first, I guess, to first approximation, the way you may think about the detection limit when using laser power is that there's the statistical nature of the photon detection, and that if I'm detecting n photons, I may have Poissonian statistics on their arrival times, and so I should have some sort of square root of n fluctuations in the photon number. And how can I do better than that? There's a few tricks. So the laser light itself has some sort of classical technical noise, but we do this balanced detection by having a balanced Michelson interferometer. When the gravitational wave comes through, you get a phase shift on the light, which is proportional to the length. That's the purple formula up there. And that phase shift produces a signal, which, according to the formula on the left, gives you a power fluctuation, which is proportional to sine phi, cosine phi, which is approximately linear in the phase shift if you sit at a place where you have a linear sensitivity. So if the arms are balanced so that you have a complete destructive interference, you have no linear sensitivity to the signal. And so in practice, what's done is we adjust it till it's completely dark and then adjust it slightly off that point, as the arrow shows you, to where we have a little bit of sensitivity to phase fluctuations in the arms. And being nearly destructively interfering works to cancel out most of the classical and technical noise sources. And then at the end, all you have left is the Poisson statistics. And that, in fact, does set a limit, although the reality of it is a little more complicated. But roughly, this is true. So in addition to these two issues, which I've talked about, there's the thermal problem with fluctuation of the mirror surface, as well as shot noise fluctuations in the detected light. There are other problems. The ground vibrates at any place on the Earth. Roughly, the vibrations of the ground are between 1 micron and 1 nanometer at the time scales we're talking about. And so you need to attenuate the vibrations of the ground by something like 10 to 12 orders of magnitude in order to do this detection. Even if you do that, as it turns out, you can't win. You can't shield yourself from just Newtonian gravity. And so the fluctuations of the Earth and of the pressure fluctuations in the air produce Newtonian gravitational perturbations on the test mass. So no matter how well you isolate it, it's still moving due to this gravity. You have to do something about that. If you have some small amount of air within the area where the laser beam goes, there'll be scattering from these stochastic fluctuations in the density of the gas that will mask any kind of signal you have. And then finally, the same photon number fluctuations that mask your detection at your detection port produce fluctuating momentum on the mirrors, which also look like just a stochastic force and will mask any kind of gravitational wave signal. So all of these noise sources have to be addressed in some way in order to make this possible. I don't want to go through all of them, but I'll tell you about a couple of them. So the initial LIGO detectors were proposed in the late 80s and were constructed throughout the late 90s. The promise to the NSF was that we would make a detector which would have an RMS strain sensitivity of 10 to the minus 21. And this curve on the y-axis is the spectral density of strain fluctuations, and on the x-axis, frequency. This is a theoretical sensitivity plot which was given to the U.S. National Science Foundation, and we promised to meet this. It was kind of a backbreaking promise. So in the future, we learn not to make promises, but. When I started out in graduate school, I started working on this early days of this detector, and we started off, and the sensitivity was, after a year or so, was that red curve that you can see up there, 10 to the minus 14 meters per square root of hertz. And I thought, wow, pretty cool. That's a small number. And because I didn't know about any of these promises to anybody. I just thought, it's fantastic.
we were able to measure tiny fluctuations. And I remember when I was telling one of the teachers in my, one of the professors in my class, I said, wow, we're only six orders of magnitude away from where we promised we would be. And he said, what a disaster. What are you gonna, how are you gonna explain this to the taxpayers? I said, well, I don't know, I'm just a student. It's not my problem. Anyway, that was the, you know, several of us spent the rest of our life, or most of our lives working on this. So we've spent 4 or 5 years and slowly finding out what were the problems. And they were really, the whole discrepancy between the, you know, theoretical and actual sensitivity came about because people who were designing the system at the time didn't understand how to scale things from a kind of cartoon detector, like I showed you before, to a real thing that has the complexity of a real low noise instrument. So in addition to all of those noise sources I described, there are a bunch of uninteresting technical ones that have to do with the experimental apparatus and so on. So it was a partly a learning experience. But anyway, at the end, after spending several more years than we had hoped, we achieved this sensitivity here at the bottom, this maroon one, which is pretty close to the pink line, which is the theoretical sensitivity. So it wasn't as easy as expected, but the detectors worked as expected after drastic overhauls. So, and I'll skip through this, but just to show you, this is kind of the same as the as a plot I showed you before. The real limits, as we learned at the end of the day, were a lot more complicated than just drawing a few lines of the power law. There were a lot of things with detailed, rich character going to them, and we learned more about the detectors, and they in fact were limited by these fundamental noise problems, but there are other issues too. So then we thought what to do, how to upgrade, and there are all kind. I mean, as you saw from the last slide, there's all kinds of issues. You have a question? Here. Yeah. One of the features I think you see is that the density of spikes changes a lot as you go throughout the years. At the beginning, they came from radiation from the kind of power supplies we were using for the experiment. But even at the end, there are quite a few spikes. There's spikes at the multiple of the mains frequencies, which are 60 hertz in the US. It turns out to be an unfortunate frequency because the Crab pulsar has a gravitational radiation at almost exactly 60 hertz. And in Europe and parts of Japan, it's 50 hertz, so they get away with a little bit easier every time. There's also vibrations, internal vibrations of the mechanical eigenmodes of the mirrors and the wires which we use to support the mirrors. And then a few of these lines are intentionally added so that we have a known displacement signal in the data stream that we can use to calibrate our system so that we're not fooling ourselves by accidentally dividing by 1,000 or something. We put in a known motion to know what we're doing. As you can see from this plot, the density of noise sources at low frequencies is quite a bit, even if you don't pay attention to the labels, and the density of noise sources at high frequencies is less. So I thought, let's do something that just improves the high frequency sensitivity. And the best way to do that is just to use a more powerful laser. We were already at the level of having tens of kilowatts of laser power. I think it seems like an unimpressive number. If you look at the radiant power you get from a light bulb, it's easily, you know, these light bulbs that are shining in my face right now are sort of hundreds of watts, which for a light bulb is not really a lot. It's an everyday level of power. But if you have a laser which has a 100 watt power output, it will cut your fingers off immediately. And it's just because all of this light is coherent and it's focused. Whereas the light from this light bulb is incoherent. So it's really, these are really high laser power levels. And so we were already running at the level where there was so much power that the radiation pressure is significant. So we thought, well, let's increase it anyway and let's see what we can do. The first limit is that the laser power becomes so powerful that the main mechanical restoring force in the mirrors is the radiation pressure, which seems It seems like an unbelievable statement. At the moment that we started to do this, the mirrors had a mass of 10 kilograms. So that's a piece of glass, roughly this big, and they're separated by 4 kilometers. And yet, there's so much laser power running around between these two optics that moving one of the mirrors 4 kilometers away affects the orientation and position of all of the other optics just through the optomechanical restoring force. And so rather than a system where we have a bunch of independent objects, the laser power running around in the system couples all of the optics together and makes for quite complicated dynamics. And we found this was although in retrospect, it's pretty obvious, and you can calculate it using simple geometry and linear algebra. It had been overlooked in the design of these detectors. And so we ran into these instabilities empirically and then figured out a way to solve them just by making a change of basis. And rather than considering them as individual optics, we considered the whole system as a set of coupled harmonic oscillators. So that worked. We were able to get to higher powers just from that. And then the second limit was that so much, you know, when we had tens of kilowatts and we upgraded to 100 kilowatts or so later, we found that the optics were just getting too much distorted, and it started to look like, sort of looking through a Coke bottle or something. The images were just distorted of the laser beams going through there. So we implemented an adaptive optics system to apply rings of counteracting heat on the optics to make a sort of anti-distortion pattern and clean up the light that was coming out. And that worked also after a couple of years of work. And so after doing that, we were able to increase the laser power and got something like a factor of 2 improvement in the sensitivity. And that's the blue curve you can see here. And now compared to the LIGO detectors, which are the blue one, you can see there's the purple curve, which is the French-Italian Virgo detector located in near Pisa, Italy. And then the German GEO detector near Hanover, Germany. And the orange one is the 300-meter Tama detector in Japan. So the U.S. one is the best in this middle audio band, and the European one is the best below about 50 or 60 hertz. So that concluded in 2010, and people looked through the data then and for the next couple years, and so far there has been no. I mean, over the past, since the beginning of the field, there's been no detection of gravitational waves, and so we've been thinking to ourselves, well, what to do next? There's been significant investment in both in money and in many years of many people, and should we call it quits or do something new? And I think people in the field felt like we're not yet finished. There's more that we know how to do. This initial version of detector was made in a kind of conservative way where we used technologies that everyone was certain would work, but we haven't yet gone to the extreme of using the best ideas that we have. And we thought the thing to do is to make a detector where it's no longer an ambiguous question. We should make a detector where even using pessimistic astrophysical estimates, we'll have guaranteed detections within, you know, a few months or a year of running. And by optimistic estimates, we would have many, many, many detections. And so that's been the philosophy of the next generation interferometers, which are being installed now and should be operating in a year or so. So this is a graphic which shows what the impact of that is. The sensitivity of the detectors is nearly isotropic. So one of these L-shaped detectors has a pretty good sensitivity in all directions. And so you can imagine that increasing the sensitivity by a factor of 2 gives you a factor of 2 to the 3 in the number of events. Although, you know, 0 events times 2 to the 3 is still 0. So that's maybe not so good. But the best we can do is make estimates of the rates based on population synthesis models of the galaxy, and we have observations of these kinds of sources from other detectors. So the new detectors will have a sort of a different character, and I can go through these noise sources for anyone who's interested, but roughly the idea is
for the detector to be limited entirely by this purple curve, which is the fact that at high frequencies we're limited by this shot noise in the detection, not enough light, and at low frequencies by the fact that we have too much light, that laser power is so high that the Poisson fluctuations in the photon number give you a fluctuating radiation pressure force. So if you increase the laser power, that low frequency part of the curve will increase and spoil your sensitivity there, and decreasing the laser power ruins the sensitivity above 100 hertz or so. And so it's the power is just adjusted to be at this trade-off place where we think we can make the best detections of some sources. So the mirrors, this is a picture of the mirrors of the initial version of the detector. This is a 10 kilogram piece of glass, and it's 25 centimeters in diameter. In the new concept, and in fact, which are now installed, these mirrors will be suspended from another set of optics, which are suspended from a chain of masses and so on. And it's basically a series of coupled harmonic oscillators in series. And each set will give us some layer of vibration isolation. And so since in the past we got away with one layer and one factor of F squared, we thought we would multiply that effect by four by having four in series. So if one is good, four is better. And so this is a picture of one of them installed in the actual vacuum system. And a more close-up view of them so you can get a sense of how large they actually are. The upper plot there is a phase map of the optic, which shows you that over the full 30 centimeter aperture, or nearly full 30 centimeter aperture, the total fluctuations in the shape of the mirror are only plus minus a nanometer or so. So it's an extremely smooth, well-polished optic. This is really the state of the art. There's no company in the world which can do as good as this. Well, obviously there's one, but no more than one. And the optic is really huge. This is a basically average-sized human being, and you can see how big it is relative to human being. She's a little smaller than me. So this is a piece of glass of this size. So it's too heavy now to lift by normal human hands. And so we have this robotic arm that carries these things around and installs them. Let me move on here. So mainly I've talked about the US LIGO detectors, and which are the orange circles here. The purple one is the Italian one, and the green one is a future Japanese one, which is meant to be as sensitive as the US LIGO detectors. Yeah, I say US detector, but I think we all think of the Washington one as the partially Canadian detector. There are so many people from UBC and Triumph there that it's almost over the border. So anyway, there's this Japanese one. And the idea is that the two here in the US, the Italian one and the Japanese one, would be roughly comparable. And then you would have a four detector network. But from this kind of plot, you can see we're really missing anything in the southern hemisphere. And all of the detectors are nearly in plane on the Earth. And that makes for a bad pointing network. And so for a while, we tried to get a detector in Australia. As it turns out, there's not many Australians. And so there's not enough money in Australia to pay for one of these. We could also put one in Argentina or South Africa, perhaps. But there were similar issues with money. India and China seem like the countries who have the most money recently. And so we approached both of those countries. China has some interest, but India has really quite a lot of interest. And so we were now looking into the possibility of relocating one of the LIGO detectors into India, and making this detector have a better baseline. And so these numbers are just meant to reflect the light travel time between the detector sites. So it gives you an idea of how valuable it is to have a certain link in the network. In it,
No, that's not what I meant. Yeah, I should have said. So each of these circles represents one Michelson interferometer. Yeah. So these links are virtual links from recombining the data. Yeah. Otherwise, that would be a truly great detector. Yeah. Beyond our budget. So these are the antenna patterns, which I alluded to before. So you can imagine maybe this one on the right. Those are the arms of the interferometer, and you can imagine placing one of these at each one of these circular zones. And so there's this peanut-shaped object coming out from each place, and then you combine them coherently to make the network sensitivity. I'm just showing this here in a slightly different representation. So the upper plot are circles of uncertainty in a source position using just a three detector network, the two LIGO detectors and the one detector in Italy. And so you can see there's areas of the sky where you have quite a big uncertainty in where the source is, and then there's places where the red X's are where you have essentially no sensitivity. And the addition of the Indian detector, roughly in the center of India with a kind of unguided orientation, is able to fix up all of these dark patches in the sky and make it so that for almost any position in the sky, sharing data with all of these detectors would allow you to nearly unambiguously point to where the source was in the sky. And the power of this technique is that you can then imagine using wide field optical follow-ups and gamma ray follow-ups to make a really combined picture of the source. So you would have gravitational wave waveform and several kinds of electromagnetic information at the same time. And we'd be spanning really, well, we'd be able to see the source and hear the source sort of at the same time. Anyway, this is not yet a done deal. We've gone through several levels of approval. The National Science Board has given a go-ahead to the National Science Foundation, there's several levels. It's sort of a bootstrapping level of go-ahead. Everyone has to approve more or less at the same time, and it's now at the cabinet level in India. So, the Indian politicians are considering whether or not to give us the final approval, but. Everyone there and in the gravitational wave community looks very high on this, so I think we have very good chances of getting a go-ahead. We don't yet have a site selection confirmed in India, but we're looking at some remote sites within north-central India and west-central India. Okay. So assuming that all works out, these detectors should be, the LIGO detector should be on in a couple of years and giving us reasonably good scientific data in maybe 2 to 3 years. And the other detectors of the network may come on by the end of the decade or so. And then what to do? Well, with the existing systems, we've placed upper limits on the rates of gravitational wave events and binary coalescences throughout the galaxy and beyond. And we expect that as these future detectors come online, we'll be able to do the sort of early astronomy, and we'll have several detections. And detections will no longer be an extremely rare occurrence, but we'll still be at the state of just telling you that there are such and such events happening at these places. But we won't yet be at the place where we're using the gravitational wave waveform in order to do really precision cosmology and tests of new physics, which is I think what we all would like to have from it. And so there's a time period between 2020 and 2030 or so where we will have some detections, but we won't be at the scale of building truly enormous LHC style gravitational wave detectors. And so what some of us have done is try to figure out what can we do to upgrade the existing systems without spending a whole lot of money and to get into this realm of doing precision astrophysics. And so there are a whole host of reasons to do this. We'd like to make tests of fundamental physics like massive gravitons and O'Hare theorems for black holes to see if, in fact, there are such things as intermediate mass black holes and what are their number in globular clusters. By extending the detectors to lower frequencies, we'd like to find out, we'd like to be able to get information about these compact binaries before they merge. If we could detect them tens of minutes or even an hour before they merge, that would give us plenty of time to point gamma ray and optical telescopes toward the place where a coalescence will happen. And we'll get really the first pre-warning of gamma ray bursts. It'll lead to all kinds of exciting science. And for me, I think personally, what I would really like to do is to be able to detect so many gravitational wave signals out to cosmological distances that we can use it as a way to map the universe out to very early times. And I think, if in fact there are such things as population 3 black holes, we should be able to detect hundreds of solar mass black holes back to a redshift of 10 or 15, if such sources exist. And that would be besides looking into the extremely early inflationary universe, this would be the furthest back in time we could look with gravitational waves. So I think all of this is possible, and it's just a matter of it's a matter of where the community wants to put its willpower. So just to remind you, these are the limits we have, and I'll just tell you about two of the techniques, which I think are we have a lot of very interesting techniques to get rid of these noise sources, and they're all clever. But some of them, the ones I work on, I think are more interesting than the other ones, because that's the kind of person I am. So this is the gravitational potential fluctuations that I was telling you about. So the cartoon is that one of the optics of the interferometer is this yellow circle that's suspended from some vibration isolation system, and then a seismic wave comes through the ground, and you have this little bubble of overdensity, delta M, there. And this fluctuation in the density yields a motion of the mass. And like I said, there's no way to shield against this. We don't know how to shield gravity. On the other hand, it's a completely deterministic process. There's no quantum uncertainty in Newtonian gravity. And if your computer knew the location and the velocity of all of the atoms within the nearest kilometer of the test mass, there would be nothing to it. You could predict exactly the gravitational potential. But we don't have that kind of perfect knowledge. So we're somewhere between the regime of zero knowledge and full knowledge. And so what we do is we place seismic sensors, like this one up there throughout the ground. This red balloons image is just a picture of what one of these arrays may look like. We bury a cluster of seismic sensors throughout the ground, and we use these to figure out what the gravitational force will be on the mirror. And in general, it's extremely complicated, because you would need to have quite a sophisticated model of seismicity and shear waves and occlusions and scatterings, and it's a very dirty topic. It's nothing anybody wants to do. So we don't do that. Instead, we just use a learning algorithm. And it's kind of an analog of these Bose noise-canceling headphones that you've seen before. So we put tens of seismometers in the ground. They have independent data streams. And then we have a gravitational noise signal in our interferometer. And we just train the computer to, over time, learn and subtract those out. And it's the technique is just a usual Wiener filtering. And there's all kinds of algorithms that have been developed by the electrical engineering community to do acoustic noise cancellation. And so we've done this and shown that, as a proof of principle on the Caltech 40-meter prototype, that it can be done. It takes something like 15 or 20 minutes for the computer to learn how to subtract out the noise to the 90% level. And then we implemented it on the LIGO detectors during the last science run and subtracted out something like 90% of the seismic vibration. We're not yet sensitive enough to get at the actual gravitational fluctuation, but we are able to subtract off the direct seismic influence. So this seems like an okay technique, and it's reasonably straightforward to scale it up in the future. The other problem is with this, much more serious problem, is with this so-called quantum noise, with too much laser power, not enough laser power. Well, the picture I told you about Poisson fluctuations is not really true. There's no reason that the laser power itself should have these Poisson fluctuations. The laser is extremely stabilized, so the light source itself doesn't have this issue. Instead, what's happening is we have one unused port of the interferometer, and from that port comes in the vacuum state of the electromagnetic field. There's nothing to block it. And the vacuum state has some level of fluctuation, and the noise that you actually see, which we usually call shot noise, is actually just the fluctuation of the ground state of the electromagnetic field beating with the static electromagnetic field which is coming from the laser. So there's, you know, electromagnetic field of the laser and tiny electromagnetic field of ground state, and the RMS fluctuations in this are just due to the fluctuation of ground state. And what can we do? Well, you can't get beyond the Heisenberg limit. You have to have some sort of uncertainty in the field. But what we can do is engineer the field so that it has most of its fluctuation in a degree of freedom that we're not interested in. And so that's in fact what we do. We adjust it so that at the higher frequencies, where mainly we're interested not in the amplitude of the laser light, but in the phase, we adjust it so that all of the uncertainty in the field is in the amplitude quadrature. And at the low frequencies, where the inertial response of the mirror to radiation pressure is large, we adjust it so that there's very little uncertainty in the amplitude, and almost all of the uncertainty is in the phase quadrature. So we get the best of both worlds by having the noise minimized in both regions. And so there's an optimum way to rotate this uncertainty ellipse and put the uncertainty just how you like it. And it's a technique called squeeze light generation. It's been around, the idea has been around from Carl Caves since the early 80s. It was done on the tabletop level at several labs in the mid 80s. At Caltech, we implemented it on our prototype interferometer in the mid 2000s and saw a 30% reduction in the shot noise from the naive quantum limit. That's nice, but it was at very high frequencies where it's not really important for gravitational wave detection, but it was a proof of principle. The Germans implemented this on their interferometer. You can see the size of their device. It's sort of a few meters of optics. And they saw also 30, 40% reduction, although only at high frequencies, above a kilohertz or so. So there's a difference in engineering philosophies between Germany, which is this small array of optics, and what goes on in the US. You know, what a good sporty car in Germany, by the time the concept comes to the US, it's a giant boat and doesn't handle too well. And so that's what we did here as well. And so there's this extremely long, you know, 7 meter long optical table, which has the same functionality as the German system. Who knows why it's so large? But we made a squeeze light system and implemented on the LIGO detectors in the half US, half Canadian one in Washington, and at the end of 2011, just before we were shut down for an upgrade. And this is not yet published, so don't take any pictures. There was an improvement of around 20 to 30% from a few hundred hertz up to really 10 kilohertz. And most importantly, it was done without ruining the noise at the low frequencies. So in this area where the detector was quantum noise limited, we got the improvement that we expected. And the technology now seems okay. It can run 24 hours a day. And we should be able to get this kind of, it seems like a free lunch. We're beating the shot noise limit over wide frequency band. And we're doing research now to improve this factor. 20 and 30% is nice as a proof of principle, but we really like to get a factor of 3 or 4. And we're starting to see these kinds of factors on the tabletop now. And I think it's just an engineering challenge to translate it from the tabletop to the full scale system. And I think this proves that it can be done at a low level, at least. So if you put all those together, and some other things, the improvement over the so-called second generation interferometers is substantial. It's the difference between this gray dashed curve and the black one. So it's a factor of 3 to 5 at all, nearly all frequencies, which is, you know, that factor cubed in the event rate. And With this, it's kind of a moderate improvement in sensitivity. It's not orders of magnitude, but it should take us from the state of doing frequent detections to the case of doing high signal-to-noise ratio observations of astrophysical objects. And it's possible to have a detector like this running in just a decade from now. So I think when I was an undergraduate, people used to show this image and say, look, this is what we know about the universe. We have good information. COBE has detected primordial fluctuations in the CMB, and we detected gamma ray bursts. Unfortunately, the gravity wave sky is completely empty. No knowledge there. And I took that as a challenge, and I thought, maybe a few years after I work on the problem, this will be solved. Yeah, you laugh now, but I was serious at the time. And this is the modern outlook. We've got a lot more gamma ray bursts, and WMAP has given us this exquisite picture of the universe, and we've also got a grand UV picture. And this, it looks like this quadrant of the image is blank, but I mean, on my screen, I see there's something there. And that's, you know, it's partially, you have to believe. That's what I'm telling you. So if you believe, you can imagine that something is slowly appearing in that quadrant. And if you just keep staring at it for a year or two, that quadrant of the image will be as glorious as all the rest very soon. Yeah, basically, that's the conclusion of my talk, is we have never been closer to detection of gravitational waves than we are today. Thank you.
So we like to give students the first chance to ask questions. Are there any student questions? Okay, maybe. Oh, yeah.
So I don't know, what do you think, what's going to happen if you don't detect any events in the next 10 years?
You know, I think that's a very good question. People ask this a lot, and people in my area who are giving this talk always seem perturbed by this question. But I think you were right to ask that question. I ask that question when I go to see talks on dark matter detection. How long can you measure zero before you decide to switch, do something else, or do something wrong? I would say, although it's disappointing to everybody in the gravitational wave detection field, if you ignore the human part of the equation, scientifically, it's a really powerful statement to say, we made these detectors that should have detected something like 15 sources per year, and we've run them for 5 years and gotten zero. Because it very strongly rules out almost all of the physics that we've become accustomed to, our cherished beliefs of what's true. If there's really no signal, if these things are happening in the universe and there's no signals from them, so either they don't happen at all, or our whole theory of how gravitational waves are generated or how they propagate is wrong. And any one of those alternatives is a very exciting physics result, I think.
So what about your decision?
What about
your decision? What are you gonna do?
Me? What I always tell people, if you don't detect anything, I just work harder.
Yeah.
There's no end to my optimism.
Any other student questions? Okay, well, we can throw the floor open to questions from everybody else, too.
So, sorry, could you say a little about how you estimate these source frequencies, this 15 that you said? Could you say a little bit more about that?
Let's see. So going from the most infrequent ones, pulsars are known. So the continuous sources, which are just pure sinusoids, those are known to exist because there are electromagnetic observations of pulsars from very low frequencies, and then even quite a few in the audio band, and then maybe not so many above 100 hertz or so, but they exist. And then there are upper limits on how elliptical they can be. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, the efficiency for gravitational radiation is high, and so we look at how the electromagnetic signals are slowing down with time and say that let's posit that some of the slowdown of these signals is due to the fact that the spinning pulsar has a bump on it or is elliptical. And then we can make an estimate for the strength of the gravitational radiation. And then you can also, using beaming factors, you can assume that there's some of them which are unobserved and make some estimate for the galactic pulsar population. And then for each supernovae, of course, we observe supernovae optically. And then there's a similar issue. People have to do quite a lot of 3D, very intensive 3D simulations in order to try to estimate if you have this kind of core collapse supernovae, what fraction of the rest mass is radiated into gravitational waves? And the answer is almost none. So it would be challenging to detect a supernova within the galaxy. And with one of these future detectors, it'll be challenging to detect gravitational waves from supernovae within the first nearest several megaparsecs or so. And we're likely to never get to supernovae throughout the universe. For the compact binary sources, it's a combination of things. People have sophisticated population synthesis models of the galaxy where they add in lots of physics and run it for a long time to see how many neutron stars and black holes are generated. And then on the observational side, there are observations of relativistic binary pulsars. People detect the radio waves from the pulsars and detect that there's a binary by the modulation of the pulsar itself. And in all of those cases, there's big uncertainties in the rates. And so we have, I would say, for compact binaries, which have masses from one to several solar masses, the uncertainty in the rates is sort of one order of magnitude low and high. So we pick some median there. So it's really quite uncertain. If things go our way, we could be detecting a source per day or 2 days or so, or if it's on the you know, bad side for us, it could be as rare as one per year. Yes. Yeah, it can be both. Yeah, I think you're right, though. The first thing that you would do if you detect nothing is to say that we have to revise our rates. And for things like black hole binaries, for which we have no observational evidence, this is it. So we detect nothing for 5 years. That's our upper limit on the binary black hole population. But yeah, eventually you get to the limit where you would say, well, we know that we should have so many of neutron star binaries per year, and the most pessimistic estimate would still give us several detections. And then you just have you can make some sort of hypothesis and test it for, you can make two hypotheses, that physics is wrong or population synthesis is off, and test them.
Next question.
Is the stability of laser frequency an important issue? Or
yes.
So how do you control that? Because you are going for such a precision.
Yeah, we many of us spent many, many years of our lives working on just laser frequency stabilization. It's a multi-stage issue. So the reasonably good commercial lasers these days have a fractional stability of something like one part in 10 to the 10 at these audio frequencies. And then we stabilize the laser by comparing it to the length of some sort of optical cavity. And we do several stages of it. So we stabilize first to some fixed optical cavity, as people use for atomic clocks, standards all over the place. And then we compare the laser then to some sort of optical cavity in the vacuum system. And finally, for the last stage, we compare the laser frequency to the average of the two arm lengths. So the gravitational wave technically could make a signal both in the in the differential length of the two arms and in the average length of the two arms. And we choose just not to look at the average length output, and we just use that to stabilize the laser frequency. So finally, the laser frequency is just stabilized by the fact that these 4 kilometer cavities are the best frequency standard in the world. And by that point, we reach a fractional stability of a part in 10 to the 21 of the laser frequency.
Just one short question. I mean, even though your aim is gravitational wave detection, can you use this for some other purposes, like understanding quantum fluctuations better and so on?
Yeah, exactly. That's what we like to do. It's such a high precision tool at this point, then why not use it for other physics? Our main funding is for gravitational waves and astrophysics, but we imagine a time when you can do some sort of time sharing. And if these things are really so low noise, we can use these to test some theories of macroscopic quantum mechanics, breakdown of the wave function. We can think about doing entanglement between the two mirrors at the end and try to see if we can teleport the state of one cavity to the other. Basically, we use some of the similar techniques that people use in the optical mechanics community. By having such a high laser power, we're able to make the laser power be the dominant restoring force between the two masses. And since the laser field has an extremely low effective temperature because it's been stabilized, you get a high dilution factor for the apparent thermal fluctuations of this degree of freedom. So it's an extremely high precision harmonic oscillator when you couple the light field to the mirror position. And then you can do all kinds of things like use these techniques of cold damping, resolved sideband cooling, to reduce the effective occupation number of this combined optomechanical oscillator down to the level of the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. And at the ground state, we should be able to observe real quantum fluctuations. You know, see that, for example, the position and momentum degrees of freedom of this combined optomechanical system obeys the Heisenberg limit, that we're not able to go below it. And then there's even more speculative stuff, if you want to know. We can put it into cat states and in some kind of non-classical states and see how they evolve through time. Yeah, I think this is a very promising thing to do with these.
Thank you.
Oh, just an open-ended question. It was kind of continuing on what we were talking about earlier. So I know there are some alternative proposals for, you know, alternative designs for gravitational wave detectors at roughly the same frequency band or lower than LIGO. I'd just be curious to know which among those, is there one that seems the best? And for that one, what are the prospects for it doing better than LIGO and on what time scale?
Ooh.
Well, maybe take out the time scale part of the question.
Ignore the time scale part. There's two issues which are difficult if you look at this. There's the brown trace is kind of just a technical problem, just filtering out the ground noise. I think that's not so difficult. But the fundamental problems is you have a test mass which you want to use and measure some sort of strain. And how do you isolate that test mass from the ground? And usually in this community, what's been done is we suspend it by some sort of thin flexure. And you suspend it from a thin flexure, which is stiff enough in the vertical direction to oppose gravity. And you want it to be soft in this direction so that the test mass behaves like a free mass. The real problem is that because it's some sort of oscillator in this direction, the fluctuation dissipation theorem tells you that the finite coupling to the thermodynamic heat bath must couple back into this degree of freedom. And so you have some Brownian forces which are moving the mirror around. It's always coming back to Einstein. So it's Brownian noise. Brownian noise is the problem. And we don't yet know how to make a soft enough, cold enough spring to make this a non-issue at extremely low frequencies. So the ideas we're pursuing right now are atom interferometers, which have no spring. They're just actually freely falling objects. Or using some sort of electromagnetic levitation, like levitate the entire mirror with magnetic levitation. In that case, you're not touching it. I mean, there's still an effective spring due to the electromagnetic spring, but it could be much less. And then the other effect is this gravitational, Newtonian gravitational perturbations. And you know what I showed you is a way that we can subtract those to by a factor of 30 or 50 or so. But in order to go to low frequencies on the ground, to 1 hertz or a tenth of a hertz, we would have to make something like a factor of 10,000 in regressing out this gravitational noise from the data stream. And that would require a network of something like some thousands of seismic sensors to be able to map the seismic field well enough. So it's possible, but it's just expensive. But I think those are the prospects that we have right now, using this kind of active subtraction and cryogenics, magnetic levitation, those kind of techniques.
Any other questions?
How cheap are seismic sensors? Is thousands of them incredibly futuristic, or is that?
It's possible.
It's possible.
Yeah, they're maybe $1,000 a piece.
Anything else? If not, let's thank Corona again.